All right, welcome to Making the Argument. Before we get started, I have a very important announcement. We have a brand new deal with GoodRanchers.com. That's right. If you go into Good Ranchers and you use promo code Nick and you sign up for one of their subscriptions, you're not only going to get $15 off, but do you remember the old deal where you got 2 pounds of ground beef with each order? Well, we just upped the game. That's right. You can choose top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon now. Every single order you get on that subscription is going to come with free top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, or bacon. You get to choose which one if you use promo code Nick. And again, $15 off on top of that. That's a savings of $480 in meat by signing up for one of those subscriptions. Not to mention the fact that if you are looking for a gift for someone that is impossible to shop for, you can go on to goodranchers.com and get one of their brand new gift boxes. Now, this is a limited time only offer. It's part of their overall Black Friday special. So go on to goodranchers.com to get more details. Sign up for promo code Nick in order to get that deal, and let's get on with the show.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Today, we're going to be going behind the scenes with different caricatures of Republicans and some things that I've personally experienced. Then we're going to be making the argument on various cliches that are used to shut down debate and try to silence Republicans and conservatives. And then finally, we'll be talking about things that make America great with the story of Thomas Sowell.
One thing I've learned is this, in politics and in combat, cowardice is contagious, but so is courage. And if you're willing to be the first person over those ramparts, you will be shocked at how many people will come with you. I'm asking you to come with me. I'm asking you to be a part of the generation that will restore the promise of this country and breathe new life into it.
Okay, today on Behind the Scenes, we actually had one of our listeners message us and say that they would like us to talk a little bit about caricatures and caricatures of Republicans, of conservatives. And so I decided to actually talk about a story that I experienced. And at this particular time, I was a local volunteer. I was working with the local Culpeper County Republican Committee in Virginia. And I was a precinct coordinator. I was helping get information out to voters, going around, you know, making sure everyone knew where to vote, the different candidates, the different positions they stood on, et cetera. And so I'm sitting in the office and a woman comes in and she is furious. She's very, very mad. And she holds up a campaign mailer and she goes, "How do I stop this hate mail from coming to my house?" And I was a little bit confused. I said, "Well, okay, can I take a look?" And I looked at it. It was a basic Republican campaign mailer, right? It wasn't exactly incendiary. It was just talking about the differences at that time between Mitt Romney and Barack Obama, right? And this is Mitt Romney, right? It's not exactly like he's a firebrand conservative. And so I started asking her, what do you think makes this hate mail? And she started to basically talk about all the things that she was angry about. And what it really came down to is her impression of conservatives is that we were mean-spirited, we were bigoted, we were stupid, we were ignorant. And I started to realize that if I started the conversation from the standpoint of trying to walk back all the things that she was claiming about conservatives, if I was coming up with counter perspectives on policy issues, we probably weren't going to get anywhere. So instead of doing that, I just started asking her questions. You know, again, like, why do you think this is hate mail? You know, why do you think Republicans are bigoted or mean-spirited? And as we started to go through and actually share experiences, that's when I saw the conversation starting to shift. So again, the caricature was we were mean and bigoted. We were generally ignorant of the world, and we were specifically ignorant of the wonderful, you know, causes of progressive policy, right? And if we could only change our way of thinking, we would surely agree with her. But in the meantime, we were mean people. And so the first thing I did was I wanted to address the idea that conservatives are mean, that we're bigoted, that we're heartless. And so I just started talking about my experiences and growing up and knowing what it was like to, you know, have your parents get divorced and knowing what it was like to, you know, lose your home because your dad had a massive stroke at 39 and, you know, getting married young and being in the military and struggling to make ends meet because you're only making like $1,200 a month. And talking about my kids and my mom taking me on missionary trips. And the more I shared from some of my own personal experiences and the more that I demonstrated to her that I was every bit as concerned about addressing the problems of poverty, of sickness, of, you know, social ills in society as she was, she had to kind of, you know, bury that caricature that I was a mean guy, right? I was demonstrating to her just by sharing experiences that, no, I wasn't a mean-spirited person. Like, I cared about people. I cared about our country. I might have a different way of going about things than she did. And what I saw was her whole demeanor changed. So she gave up the idea that I was mean. She could see that I wasn't a mean person. My wife, Tina, was there at the time. She could see that Tina wasn't a mean person. We weren't sitting there yelling at her or screaming at her or you know, calling her names. We were honestly trying to address her questions and concerns. And so that was the first caricature we had to get rid of. We were mean-spirited. And if we had just fired back on, hey, you're wrong, and there's nothing hateful about this mail, and you know, actually, you guys are the ones pushing policies that hurt people, we would have been talking around each other the entire time, and we wouldn't have had any sort of opportunity to be able to engage in meaningful dialogue. So her next accusation went from, okay, you're mean and this is hate mail, to, well, you just don't understand, right? You know, you're young. I think I was like 32 at the time. She was, you know, you're young, you don't understand. And that's why you believe this. And maybe if, you know, maybe if you had lived a little bit more life, you know, you'll understand why, you know, the progressive position is correct and the conservative position is wrong. So she was willing to accept that I wasn't mean. I was just ignorant, right? And that explained my conservative philosophy, is I just didn't understand things. And so I remember looking at her like, okay, well, you know, maybe so. Let's go ahead and test that theory. Your theory is that I'm just kind of ignorant. I don't understand. I haven't been exposed to much in the world. And so that's why I believe the way I do. I said, so let me share you a little bit about my background. And I talked about growing up. I talked about going to Mexico on medical missionary trips. I talked about going to the Philippines. I talked about going to Japan. And this is all before I'm 15 years old. And then I talked about my mom's experiences as a nurse, my dad's experiences as a police officer. I talked about getting married young and living in multiple states. I talked about serving in the military and going overseas and serving in combat. I talked about, you know, the struggles and the joys of raising children and what that was like and our hopes for them and the sort of country we wanted them to grow up in. And as I'm explaining my perspectives, and I'm explaining my experiences and the fact that, you know, I've been to over 20 different countries for whether it was military service, whether it was missionary work. I said, do you really think that sounds like someone that is so ignorant that they can't form a political philosophy? I mean, do you not think I've earned the right through my experiences or just by being a human being to be able to use my experiences, my education, my perspectives in order to be able to come up with a coherent political philosophy? And she's sitting through and she's listening to all of these experiences that I've had and listening to me explain it. She starts to realize that this claim that I'm just generally ignorant and that's the only reason why I'm a conservative, that starts to melt away because she, you know, she can't counteract my perspectives. She can't deny the fact that I've gone out there and I've studied and I've researched and I've really tried to pull together those life experiences, the education that I've had, whether it was formal education or informal education. And so she kind of buries that argument too. Okay, so now you're not mean and bigoted. You're not generally ignorant. And so now she falls back to her kind of final argument. Well, maybe you just don't understand progressivism. Maybe you don't understand, you know, her version of liberalism. And if only I understood that, then I would see that even though I have good experience, even though I'm a nice person, that if I just spent a little bit more time considering left-wing political theory, I would see the merits of it, and then I would switch over. And so that was her hope for me, is that I would just take some more time to understand the other side. And I remember looking at her, I said, you know what? Maybe that's a fair point, but let's test it. Let's test this idea that I'm ignorant of what you believe. I said, so here's one way we can test it. For the next 5 minutes, I will present an argument for liberal ideology. I will present an argument for progressive policy positions. And I will do it in a way that you actually like to hear. I will do it in a way that you think is intellectually rigorous. I will do it in a way that when you're done hearing it, you can say, yeah, that's what I believe. So I'll do that for the next 5 minutes. And then here's what I'm going to ask you to do. I'm going to ask you to do the same thing for conservative philosophy. I'm going to ask you to explain the conservative worldview in a way that I would find convincing. Do you want to do this? And she looked at me and she goes, I don't think I could. And I said, well, if that's the case, who's the one that's ignorant of the other person's political philosophy? And she looked at me for a second and she said, you know what? I could vote for you. And I thought that was amazing. Now, look, chances are she did not vote for me, right? Because we did have very, very different views. But what the point is when you have someone coming in and the reason why they don't like you or the reason why they disagree with you is not because they understand what you believe or they understand your perspectives or understand where you're coming from, but because they have been fed a caricature of who you are. And everything within their life reinforces that caricature, whether it's popular culture, whether it's TV, music, academia, the news they watch. It has all been geared toward this idea that you're a bad person. And it's important to understand why people do that, because that's not a form of information. That's actually a form of propaganda. Because if I can convince someone that you're bad, you're mean, then they don't need to listen to your argument. Because after all, you're a bad person. And if you're a bad person, then clearly your arguments, no matter how good, are rooted in bad intentions. And so the first step in breaking down and dismantling that caricature was being able to build that personal connection based off of shared experiences. And what I have found, not only in that instance, but in so many others, is that really is the first step. Don't lead in with this whole idea of, well, that's a caricature and you're wrong and that's not what I'm about. Demonstrate that that's not what you're about by sharing something about yourself that they can relate to, that they can connect to, right? She was a parent. I was a parent. She wanted good things for society. I wanted good things for society. We had just had different ways of getting there. And it was amazing, the transformation in the conversation. And again, it doesn't always mean that someone's going to leave and now all of a sudden they agree with everything you do. But it's about, you know, to use an agricultural metaphor, it's about planting seeds. You know, I was trying to plant a seed in that moment to where somebody would not judge me based off of the caricature they heard. They judge me as an individual, and they judge my arguments based off of the merits of those arguments, not some preconceived notion of my intentions. And it really does work. And again, I've seen this happen with people all over the country as I've talked to people. When you build those personal connections, you explain where you're coming from, and then you go into the policies, and then you go into why you think those policies work, or why you go into why another policy doesn't work. It destroys the negative caricature that we're painted with, and it allows for a good conversation and civil dialogue. Okay, on this segment of Making the Argument, we're now going to switch from the caricatures that we talked about, and we're going to talk about cliches, right? These terms that are commonly used in political discourse in order to shut down debate. And it really goes back to what I was talking about before, right? There's informing and debate and argumentation, and then there's just straight propaganda. And one of the things that I have seen over and over again in modern political discourse is this idea of kind of misappropriating the use of certain words, right? Taking those words and making them mean something that they've never meant before. And I was talking to a room full of students, high school students, and they were civic students. And so they'd come in to talk to their elected representative and they wanted to ask me some questions. And some of it had to do with policy. Some of it had to do with civility and politics. And I noticed some of the terminology that they were throwing around. And so I stopped the class for a second. I said, I want to ask you guys a question. I said, who here believes in equality? Everyone raises their hand. I'm like, all right, good, good. Who here believes in diversity? Everyone raises their hand. Great. Who here believes in tolerance? Again, every single hand immediately goes up, right? It was like a Pavlov's dog response to those questions. And I said, okay, so you believe in equality. So here's my question. Do you believe that society should view a murderer the same way it views a doctor? Well, no. I'm like, oh, so you don't believe in equality? And they're like, well, no, that's not what we mean. I said, yeah, okay, but you've got to understand when you start using that term just generically, as if it has some sort of inherent moral meaning without a context, you run into problems. I said, who here believes in tolerance? Again, they all raise their hand, right? I'm like, so you would be tolerant of sexual abuse? Well, no, we'd never be tolerant of that. Oh, does that make you intolerant? Well, no, that's not what we mean. Okay, but it's what you said. All right, what about diversity? You know, if you had a room full, if you have a classroom full of well-behaved, you know, well-mannered, you know, hardworking students, how many, you know, evil, greedy people would you want to bring into this classroom and for the sake of diversity? I'm like, well, none. I'm like, okay, so the point I'm trying to make is not that there's anything inherently wrong about equality, diversity, or tolerance. The issue is that it needs a larger context to actually take on a moral meaning. And one of the frustrating parts about political discourse is that when you disagree with somebody about a particular issue, they'll accuse you of, well, you don't believe in equality. Well, okay, well, what does that mean? Like, no, I do believe in equality before the law. I do believe in the equality of everyone being able to seek out opportunities and succeed. But if your definition of equality is we're going to use government power in order to steal from one person in order to give to another person so they're more equal in their incomes, well, no, I don't believe in that because I don't think that's genuine equality. I think that's the sort of equality that destroys individual liberty and property rights for the sake of coming up with some sort of, you know, arbitrary sense of equity. You know, equality of outcomes, because that requires force to actually achieve, and it destroys all the necessary components in society that allow people to actually build themselves up and create something, right? When it comes to diversity, if the only way you look at a diversity is based off of gender or skin color, and you don't look at diversity as diversity of experiences or perspective or ideas, well, then I would say I'm not the one that's challenging diversity. You're the one that is making diversity superficial. You're basing your standard of diversity on nothing more than superficial differences between people. You're not actually getting down into the aspects of diversity, which really do have moral value and societal value. And it's the same thing with tolerance, right? There are all things that none of us would ever tolerate. None of us would tolerate murder or sexual assault or rape. None of us would tolerate one person coming in and punching another person because they disagree with their values. But if you're going to redefine tolerance into being general acceptance or celebration, and this is something we see a lot in society, the moment you disagree with somebody on something that they hold dear, they'll accuse you of being intolerant. Tolerance is not me necessarily agreeing with everything that you say. Tolerance is not me necessarily celebrating the same things you say. Tolerance is me not requiring the government or me personally going in and forcing you to believe something you don't believe or forcing you to believe what I believe. Tolerance is more like live and let live, not live the way I tell you to, or I'll go get the government to punish you for it. And that's the sort of context that is required when we use these terms. I'll never forget one day a news reporter called me up and said, why did you vote against an anti-discrimination bill? And I said, well, because it wasn't an anti-discrimination bill. It was a different discrimination bill. And the particular piece of legislation had to do with, you know, again, what they called anti-discrimination. But ultimately, what it was going to do is it was going to favor one type of discrimination, and then it was going to actually infringe on religious liberties on the other side. And I said, look, this is not an either-or proposition. We can respect both people's views and allow them to both live their lives the way they want without infringing on the liberty of other sides. But if one side of the political spectrum is going to, you know, try to flavor everything they do with the idea that if you don't agree with me, then you're for discrimination. And she kept using the term. She kept going back to it. Well, why are you for discrimination? I said, okay, stop for a second. You do realize that everything you do in life is in some way a generic form of discrimination. So the fact that this news reporter had decided to pick up the phone and call me and ask me a question, in order to do that, she had to discriminate against all the other things that she could have done in that moment. Now, was there anything wrong with the decision she made to call me up and talk to me? No. But if I look back on her, I said, well, clearly you're discriminating. I would have been using her logic in order to try to refute her question, as opposed to just understanding that she had a reasonable question to ask. And I had an obligation as elected representative to be able to answer it. And I finally stopped her. I said, I think what you're trying to fight, and I said, you and I are in agreement on this, what we're trying to fight is bigotry. See, because bigotry does have an inherent moral connotation. Bigotry is the unreasonable or irresponsible hatred for something, right? That's always wrong. There's never a situation in which bigotry is morally justifiable or appropriate. But there is situations where we can say that, okay, well, you know, we don't want equality between the doctor and the murderer with respect to how society looks at them. We might want them to both have equality before the law, because even somebody that commits a crime is entitled to due process before the law. We have to actually prove that they did it, not just suggest that they did it and punish them for it. You know, when it comes to tolerance, yes, all of us should accept a political philosophy where we say that provided you're not hurting anyone when you do something, and by hurting, I mean actually stealing from them or physically abusing them, Well, then, yeah, we should definitely be tolerant of someone that has a viewpoint different from us. We shouldn't be, you know, physically harming them or using the government to punish them. But we still have freedom of association. We can still say, I agree with your right to think that way, but I think a different way. There's nothing intolerant about that. You know, and it's the same thing with all these other terms. So it's so important when we see these cliches, the moment someone accuses you, you're intolerant, you're for discrimination, you don't like equality because you don't agree with me. Actually breaking down those terms and explaining how important context is and being able to demonstrate scenarios where they're running afoul of their own accusation is really critical to once again bring the conversation back to define your terms and to be able to have a productive discussion instead of just engaging in this kind of ad hominem attack and logical fallacies. Because ultimately, if we allow discourse to be broken down into a series of shouting matches and using terms or using words inappropriately or outside of their proper definition and context in order to shut down debate, that's not somebody that loves freedom of thought. That's not somebody that loves freedom of association. That's not someone that loves civil discourse. That's someone that's actually using the tools to destroy civil discourse. And if you look at the most authoritarian societies throughout history, and you look at their ministries of propaganda, and you look at what they tried to do, it's the exact same tactic. The manipulation of language to shut down debate instead of fostering it. And that's what we need to avoid, and that's what we need to get better at doing, demonstrating how, in order to make a proper argument, we have to define our terms and we have to be intellectually honest about what we're saying. Okay, today on the Things That Make America Great segment, we're going to be talking about one of my favorite people, one of my favorite economists, Dr. Thomas Sowell. This guy is truly brilliant. He has had just an amazing life. And he talks a little bit about his experiences in his books and in his interviews. He talks a lot about kind of tearing away some of these, what I call superficially plausible economic arguments that we hear so much. And what's fascinating is he didn't start off life as a conservative or liberty-minded thinker. He really started off life more as a Marxist. And if you look at his career at Harvard or at the Chicago School or Stanford, he will tell you about how he was a Marxist when he went into University of Chicago. He was a Marxist when he was studying under Milton Friedman. And he had this change in his life when he spent a summer working for the government. And I want to show you this quick clip of him explaining that.
I went to the University of Chicago as a Marxist. After a year of studying under Milton Friedman, I was still a Marxist. But one summer of working in the government was enough to start returning around.
Really, what happened to you there?
Well, nothing happened to me, but that I realized that the government was nowhere close to being capable of doing what people on the left wanted the government to do. And that, in fact, we'd be lucky if they didn't make things worse. For example, I was in the Labor Department, and they administered the minimum wage law. To me, the question was, did minimum wage laws make poor people better off or worse off? Mm-hmm. That was not the question for them. The minimum wage law provided one-third of their total budget, and they weren't going to look at this this other way. And as I tried to get into the question of, does this cause unemployment and stuff like that, there was no enthusiasm whatsoever for that.
So as you can see, Thomas Sowell is one of these guys that what I think is so impressive is when he was growing up in New York, he was originally born in North Carolina. He had to actually live with a different family. They moved to New York. He talks a little bit about his experience growing up within the school system, about the first time he was introduced to a library at, I think it was 8 years old. And he developed this love for learning and for working very, very hard. He was a bicycle messenger. He had done a couple of other things in New York. He had actually been a high school dropout. He was a high school dropout that got into Harvard. And when he went into Harvard, as I said earlier, he was a Marxist, right? It's not as if he was just enamored with conservative thought or free market economics or any of these things. In fact, he really thought Karl Marx was somebody that did a much better job of explaining the things that he saw around him. But the thing that's so fascinating about Thomas Sowell was he could take a perspective, but what was important to him was to actually go beyond what seemed superficially plausible or what seemed like just accepted ideas. And he would actually look at the data and he would empirically just in a very intellectually rigorous manner, he would break down the numbers, he'd break down the data, he would look for context. And then he asked a very important question that too many people don't these days in politics. And that is, do the results match the intentions? And if they don't, then you have to actually reevaluate what it is that you're suggesting. And as you saw in that clip, you know, he went down and as he was working for the Department of Labor, he thought, okay, great, minimum wage is a wonderful thing. But as he started to look at the data, he started to realize that it was actually hurting the people that he was dedicated to help. And when he brought those facts and figures forward, he expected to be patted on the back, but instead he was somewhat ostracized because all of the money that was being used for these unemployment programs funded the budget of that organization. And if Thomas Sowell's data got out or if it had an effect within that organization, it challenged the budget of the organization itself. And he really start to see how different government programs might start off with a good intention or even a good idea, but they also run into perverse incentives, and they can grow to be very, very self-serving. And instead of serving the purpose for which they were created, they end up serving the goals of the organization itself, as opposed to the reasons why it exists in the first place. And There's a few books here, and I don't even have a fraction of all the books that Thomas Sowell has written. But here's what I'd really encourage you to do. If you're looking for, you know, a kind of a quick primer to understand economics, his book Basic Economics, and this right here is the fifth edition. And I know it looks big, I know it looks, you know, just huge and somewhat intimidating. But one of the things I love about the way Thomas Sowell writes about economics is that while he's incredibly technically proficient and just absolutely meticulous in his resources and his study and his footnotes, he wrote this book so that the layman, so that anybody could understand the various principles and the policies he was talking about. So he doesn't have a bunch of, you know, really difficult mathematical equations in here and a bunch of charts that nobody would understand outside of the academics, or excuse me, the economics profession. He wrote this so that anybody could pick it up and understand what he was talking about, whether it's issues like the minimum wage or government spending or taxes or the role that prices play in our economy. He does an excellent job. I've actually used this book when I was teaching at a homeschool co-op. This was the book I used to help explain these economic principles to high school students. And they got it. They were able to understand it the way that he was writing it. And so Basic Economics by Thomas Sowell is just an absolute must read if you want to have a good understanding of how the economy works and what economics is. He has this quote that he uses that I love. And he says, "The first rule of economics is the understanding of scarcity. The idea that there's never enough to go around to meet everybody's needs, wants, and desires." And so economics is about studying how do we efficiently use those resources in order to meet the needs of people. And he says, so if the first lesson of economics is scarcity, the first lesson of politics is to ignore the first lesson of economics. And you really see that in a lot of these government plans where they act as if by simply passing a law, they can improve everything. And so I really encourage you to check this out. Another one that's really good is the Thomas Sowell Reader. This is actually a compilation of a lot of the different articles he's written. So if you're looking for something that is really easy to pick up and read, you know, two or three pages from an essay he wrote or from a column he wrote, and then you can set it back down and come back to it later, Thomas Sowell Reader is phenomenal. It will give you a really good overview of all of the different topics that he has written on. Because while he is an economist, he writes about a lot of social issues. He writes a lot about affirmative action. And as someone that grew up in North Carolina, he was incredibly poor. In New York, he was really poor. He was growing up in an era where there were still a lot of laws on the books that deliberately discriminated against people because of their skin color. He understands the arguments on both sides, and he didn't just study things like affirmative action in the United States. He studied them all over the world to try to get a better idea of, do these programs actually work? And that's what I just find so amazing and what I appreciate so much about him is that despite the fact that he is brilliant, and if he wanted to, he would be, you know, more than capable of certainly talking about all these issues above my head. He really tries to break it down in such a way to where he doesn't dumb down the concepts, but he speaks about it in a way that is relevant to just about anybody that would pick up these books with a desire to understand economics, where he's coming from, the social implications. And I have to tell you, it's I don't fanboy much. But one of my goals is to one day meet Thomas Sowell in person and to really just say thank you. because here was a person that he wasn't going to have his life dictated to him by caricatures or cliches. He wasn't going to allow a belief system to go unchallenged simply because it was superficially plausible or it was popular. He wanted to know what is true. And he dedicated his life to not only finding out what was true and to be able to logically demonstrate it and empirically demonstrate it, but then to be able to share his discoveries with the population at large in a way that we could all understand and relate to. And for that, we owe Dr. Thomas Sowell a huge debt of gratitude. And I would just say that when I think about the different things and the different people that have made America great and a demonstration of what can happen in a free society where someone is able to rise up from humble beginnings and have such an incredible impact on America and on their fellow men and women, Thomas Sowell sits up very high to the top for me. And so I would just like to say thank you to Thomas Sowell. And I encourage all of you to read his columns, read his books, look at his interviews. One of the best places to go is a website called Uncommon Knowledge. And Peter Robinson does a whole series of interviews with Thomas Sowell, and you will find them very enjoyable. The other thing I like about Dr. Sowell, he's a smart aleck, so he is fun to listen to. For a guy that's so brilliant, he's not at all dry. He's very fun to listen to, very engaging. And so check that out. And again, thank you, Dr. Sowell. Okay, that is all the time we have today on Making the Argument with Nick Freitas. I want to thank you for tuning in. Also, if you are interested in getting any of these books by Thomas Sowell, if you look in the show notes page, we're going to have links to where you can actually purchase these books. I highly encourage it. It will be some of the best $20 you ever spend. The other thing I would ask you all to do is really consider leaving us a 5-star rating. If you like the arguments, if you like the content that you're seeing on the show, leaving us a 5-star rating is one of the best ways that we can get this message out to more people, share it with your friends. Also, give us feedback on the sort of content that you would like to see. A big part of this show was actually inspired by someone coming in and asking us a question. So we do take your comments very seriously. We love to see them. We love to be able to interact. Again, thank you for taking the time to join us. And this is Nick Freitas with Making the Argument. Once again, thank you very much for listening. If you want to support the show, again, one of the best ways you can do it is by heading over to goodranchers.com with promo code Nick. You're going to get $15 off. You sign up for one of those subscriptions and you're going to get up to $480 of free meat with that subscription. You get to pick top sirloin, salmon, chicken breast, bacon. It is all up to you. Plus, if you're looking for gifts to get for the people that are impossible to shop for, goodranchers.com also has gift boxes. You need to act quick. This is part of their overall Black Friday special. So head on over to goodranchers.com, use promo code Nick, and once again, thank you for listening.